I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Ian Brown joins me again. The award-winning author of The Boy in the Moon has a new book out, 60, A Diary of My 61st Year. When he turned 60 on the 4th of February 2014, he began keeping a diary. This book is a chronicle of this year where he works through what being 60 means. It also provides the honest, humorous, and candid thoughts running through Mr. Brown's mind as he leaves his middle-aged years thinking about family, the future, money, and sex. It's a terrific book, and as he suggests, lights a path for an oncoming generation. Ian Brown is an author and feature writer for the Globe and Mail. He has won numerous awards, including National Magazine and National Newspaper Awards. The Boy in the Moon, A Father's Search for His Disabled Son, was a national bestseller, a New York Times and Globe and Mail best book, and the winner of the Charles Taylor Prize, the BC National Award for Canadian Nonfiction, and the Trillium Book Award. His previous books include Freewheeling and Man Overboard. This new book is published by Random House. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Ian Brown. Mr. Brown, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you again.
The same, the same. So how old was your father when he died?
98.
So do you look to your future saying that you have, say, 35, 40 years to go?
My ophthalmologist tells me that I should approach life that way. I, you know, being a nervous Nelly type, I would say that I probably, you know, the average, but from the time I turned 65, which is in 4 years now, so from that point on average, I would have 21.4 years to live. So if you add those together, that means I've got 25 and a half years to go. Which would mean I would be 85 when I, you know, pegged out.
Mm-hmm.
And that would mean 25 years. So that's the difference between going from, say, 25 to 50. So a lot happened to me between 25 and 50. And so I think to myself, well, even if it's just 25, I can get a whole other second go at it, you know.
Yeah,
that way.
Yeah, you think about that in the book. I mean, you do wonder if you should change careers, if you should, you know, craft out a new life. So I'm curious to know, have you?
Well, I have certainly, I would say I'm writing more now than I ever have, and writing more consistently, and taking on things that I was afraid to take on before. So I would say I'm more serious about because, you know, it could be, I mean, you know, you even at my age, you know, and I'm not that old compared to somebody who's, you know, in old age,
mm-hmm.
but the desire to deny what's going on, the desire to deny the fact that, you know, we age from the moment we're born, and that it gets faster and faster, or seems faster and faster, as the amount you have left is a, you know, it's just a fraction of your life as opposed to the whole thing. The desire to deny it, it's really very strong. So there are lots of days when I get up and I think, oh, well, if I make it to 95, like, you know, my mom did,
mm-hmm.
oh, that means I've got 35 years left. But, you know, I don't know, beyond 80, I mean, I can barely remember my name some days as it is. at 80, God knows what I'll be writing. It'll be like my grocery list over and over and over again. I'll be submitting it as a novel.
So I had Camilla Gibb on about a month or two ago, and I'm sure you're familiar with her book, which is a great book about this sort of period in her life where it had all gone to hell.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear her name.
Camilla Gibb?
Oh, yes, of course.
And so in the book, she says that while she was trying to process whatever was going on in her life, she talked to you, and your advice to her was just to keep writing and write it all down. So
yeah.
Was that what you had in mind when you decided to keep a diary of this momentous year in your life?
Yes. I mean, I realized that the you know, saying 60 is the age is a bit artificial, but it was a nice round number. I think some... You know, starting at 55, when I began to notice a few, you know, my knees weren't quite as pain-free as they used to be. You know, it can start in around there. It starts earlier for some people. You know, I mean, Philip Larkin, the poet, was fully aware of his mortality at about the age of 35. Some people, you know, Jack Rabbit Johansson was a brilliant skier. I mean, he was still skiing with the best of them at the age of 95. But what happened for me is that I kept having one of two reactions. You know, I would wake up in the morning and I would remember, you know, Harold Pinter's famous imprecation to tell death to go to hell. Or I would wake up and I would be a, you know, quivering mass of sniveling worry. You know, my God, we're getting old. My life is meaningless. I've done nothing. You know, it's a failure, blah, blah, blah. And I would read these self-help books that would say, you know, younger next year, sexy at 60. And they all, or else there's the other kind of book that says, you know, life is over, death is coming. And yeah. And it was, you know, that the book said you must live one way or the other. And I found in my real life that both of those things happened on an alternate or, you know, unpredictably. And I thought, there's, you know, real life is suggesting that we occupy many different approaches to getting older and being alive or getting closer to death and not, you know, at once. And what I wanted to do was make a chronicle of a stretch of time so that I could watch the passage of that stretch of time and see whether you noticed anything. But I didn't want to, you know, be self-helpy or non-self-helpy about it. I just wanted to make this chronicle because I wanted to sort out what I should be paying attention to and what I shouldn't be paying attention to.
So someone who's 33, I shouldn't read this book as a sort of instruction manual as how to get to 60, or should I?
Well, I think you should. I think you should read it as one person's attempt to engage. And, you know, for me, I mean, you know, I used to read, you know, I can read the diary of a young person. I can read the diary of an old person. I can read a novel. But I'm interested in how other people live their lives. And this is an attempt to explain how other people, how another person lives his life when, you know, the society in general says you're not supposed to be living much of a life anymore. You're really supposed to be chilling out, cruising out, retiring, calming down, shutting it. You know, the end is coming. Thank you very much. We've heard enough from you. I mean, there's a lot of that pressure, I find, in contemporary society, whether it's driven by capitalism that says I'm no longer a useful consumer, I'm not a good category anymore, whether it's, you know, younger people who want my job, who are saying, you know, why don't you hurry up and die, and I don't want to pay for your health bills anymore. And they may be, in fact, in denial of their own aging, and so I remind them of their aging. So, God forbid, they don't want to see me around. You know, there's the corporate, you know, I'm expensive if I've got a pension, and I'm probably paid a bit more because I've been around longer, so they don't want to see me. There's a lot of pressure to make you shut the hell up. As you get older, and while your body may be slightly less reliable, I mean, if you're lucky, your mind is more experienced, and so you know those are competing tensions. So I would say to somebody who's 33, I mean, you're a very talented guy. I think you can take my example to remind yourself, not at 60, but at 33, to seize it every day. Because at 33, you think, well, I've still got, I don't have to start seizing it quite yet. It's not real yet. But it, believe me, you know, the human, as I discovered when I became obsessed about, you know, reading about the physical decay at one point during this year of living diaristically, you know, the human brain expands till it's 28, and then it says, okay, that's full size, and then it starts to shrink. From 20, you know, by 35, your skin is starting to decay. It happens a lot earlier than you realize. So I would say read my book and, you know, take note.
Your wife says something pretty profound in the book. She says that when she was in her 20s and 30s, she thought that when she was in her 50s, that would be her heyday. But in fact, yes, it was her 20s and 30s, and she sort of missed it.
Yes, and she didn't really miss it because she, you know, she's a great writer, and she lived a very full life. She lived in New York. She worked for GQ magazine. She pursued her dream, which is to know as much as she could about movies and films and the television. So she actually didn't. She thinks she missed her heyday, but she's quite right. I mean, when she was in her 20s and 30s, when, you know, she had kids, we were running around like mad people. You know, we were speeding by the details. And she thought to herself, well, yeah, when I'm 50, then I'll be able to stop and sort of, as to use that old cliche, smell the roses.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, as you know, the best times, the most available opportunities to her, especially because she's a woman, she's an older woman, you know, and things, you know, people start to think older women are not worth having around. It turns out that she had the most opportunity when she was in her 30s. So, yes, I that is, a, you know, she's always saying profound things, though. She's a deep one.
She's a brilliant writer.
Yeah, that's fantastic, yeah.
So, when you look at this year, since you're busy chronicling it, I don't know when you do it. I guess at the end of the day, perhaps, or
generally in the morning.
In the morning, okay.
Yeah.
Does it give you because you take the time to write about it? Does that give you, say, more of an understanding of what happened in your life?
Yes, you remember more. I mean, I remember more. You know, because you've taken note of it and you've written it down. And you know, once you start writing about something, this morning. I got up and I was staying at the St. Regis Hotel in Vancouver, and I had a cup of coffee from the machine in the room. It was a machine, kind of machine I'd never seen before. And it was, I know what the worst cup of coffee I've ever had in my life was.
Yeah.
And I'm not joking. It's the second worst cup of coffee I've ever had in my life. And so, you know, I made some notes about that, about the, you know, lack of undernotes, the, you know, complete, you know, absence of overnotes as well. And that got me into writing about hotel rooms and about that hotel room. Because it's Vancouver, there's another condo right across the way. And I watched two people get up, get dressed, make their breakfast, and start their day. So you begin writing about one detail, but the discipline and the continuous regimen of writing every day makes you pay attention to other things as well. I mean, I remember talking to a great friend of mine, Sinclair Stewart, who's the managing editor of the Globe and Mail.
Yeah.
He was a reporter, and a brilliant reporter, great writer, energetic guy. And I said to him, do you think people will remember what you've written in the future? And he said, I don't know about that, and I don't care about that, and there's no point in thinking about that. He said, but I would like to remember what I myself have written. And you can go through, you know, there's so much pressure, and there's so many distractions. You can zoom through your existence without paying attention to it. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about getting older. As you get older, you panic when you think, I've got so much left to do. You know, I want to listen to Joe Planet's radio show. I want to read War and Peace. I want to read this new novel that's come out. I want to go and make a great meal, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you think if you go faster and pay less attention to detail, you'll be able to pack in more. And the paradox is that if you don't pay attention to details, you don't notice anything. And ironically, you have to slow down. I found, anyway, that if I stopped panicking, and I just paid attention to what really grabbed my hackle of interest, right? And not the stuff that's supposed to be interesting or that other people tell me is important or that I want to believe is important because it'll make me look cooler or something. But the stuff that actually reaches out and grabs me in some way, if I pay attention to that and really pay attention to those few details by slowing down, it actually becomes all deeper and more memorable, at least to me. And so time actually stops a little bit, and that's fantastic.
Do you worry, though, Ian, about burying yourself too much? I mean, there's stuff in the book that you write that I probably wouldn't say about myself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a couple of details that I'm very nervous about. you know, there's a little passage about masturbation that I'm having second thoughts about. There's a couple of physical afflictions that perhaps were unwise. But, you know, I mean, it's a dilemma. If you don't have something at stake when you write, I'm not trying to be pretentious about this. I mean, this is true of, I'm a journalist, right? I'm a newspaper writer, a magazine writer, and occasional book writer. So I'm not writing deathless prose. But if you don't have something at stake, the writing means less. It just does, you know? And that can be true if you could be writing about, you know, the bicycle lanes in Vancouver, you know? But if you don't find something important or something on the edge or that matters about that, it won't resonate. And it's especially true when you're writing about yourself. So you sort of have to put something on the line to help people invest. You know, I'm asking a reader to spend however many hours it is reading this book. I think I have to put something on the line for that.
The other thing that struck me in the course of reading your book, you talk about money a lot, and you know, we all assume that when we get to your age, we'll be fine. You know what I mean? Because when at 33, we're worried about money already.
Yeah.
So when you look back, are there regrets when it comes to how you say spent your money?
I've been a writer most of my life, so I haven't had all that much money to spend. I think I probably could have been more careful. I certainly could have started and I'm better off than a lot of people. So, you know, I've got enough to retire on. Although, you know, I keep reading in the newspaper, you should have $3 million to retire on.
Yeah.
I read this in the news, I think, who's reading the newspaper? Like, it can't be any of my pals. Because, you know, we're all thinking of, you know, dealing in drugs to make, some money to make a little extra. But, so I guess I wish I had started my RRSP, I'd taken it seriously right from the beginning. I wish I'd taken a few more risks financially. I remember at one point my wife and I thought about buying a little tiny rotten cabin on Georgian Bay, and we didn't because we thought it would be a bit anxious making to make the payments on it. I wish we'd done that. I wish we'd taken that chance. I mean, part of it is writing and not staying at one place all my life, which is not great for a writer. So it's almost structural, this nervousness about money. But I wish I'd been bolder about being serious about it earlier on. Yes.
And the other thing that's reassuring is that even at 60, you're still thinking about sex, because all guys do, right?
Well, I think not just guys. I think women themselves. I recently ran into a woman in Banff, a very, very, very smart doctor, very clever person. She's 59 years old. And I said, how are you doing? And she said, oh, you know, pretty good, pretty good. My social life is picking up. And I said, oh, and she was with two or three of her friends. I said, well, and she had been widowed. And she was quite wealthy. Her husband was a big business guy. And so she had money. And, you know, there's a lot of people in Calgary who are like her, women who've been divorced, you know, by their oil and gas husbands and have been replaced by trophy wives. And I said, well, what do you mean about your social life? She said, well, I'm dating four guys. And I said, oh, really? Four at once? He goes, yep. And I said, do they know each other? She said, oh, yeah, they all know about the other. I said, well, how old are they? She said, well, one is over 60. I'd like to have one over 60 because it's a sort of reliable. I said, well, how old are the other ones? She said, well, she says, I have a personal rule. I don't go below 40. Oh, really? So you've got three guys between 40 and 60 and one over 60. And are you sleeping with all of them? She said, oh, yes. I have sex with each of them once a week. I said, what? No. What has happened? You know, are you on some sort of pill? And she said, I don't know. And she turned to her friends. She said, you all got basically the same arrangement, don't you? And they all went, yeah, yeah. That's right. So I don't think it's just guys at 60 who are thinking of sex. I think women are fully engaged. They may be engaged in different ways. It's a continuing problem, sex. Desire is a continuing problem. The slight problem is that, you know, as you get older, you begin to realize how fascist physical attraction is. You know, that physical attraction is physical attraction, and people are attracted to the physical, and there are certain things that are proportions or youth. I mean, I see my wife and her friends go into sort of paroxysms of sort of silliness. They start giggling whenever some young guy goes by without his shirt on. Like, I mean, they're responding to some kind of ceremonial, ancient, I don't know what it is, equation. But it's just happening there. And that doesn't happen so much to you when you're 60, you know. In fact, it probably hasn't happened for 20 years. So that's a bit sad and can be... But there are ways around that. You know, you can begin to... I don't want to rant on about this, but yeah. I was noticing in the course of writing the diary that my own... You know, I was always quite Catholic, and you know, in my tastes, and was drawn to all kinds of people, all kinds of women and types and ages and everything. But and not always acting on it, but always found a wide range attractive, physically and emotionally and intellectually. But as I get older, I find my tastes are even more Catholic. My stereotype has become less of a stereotype. It's broadened. I'm not trying to be self-congratulatory here, but I actually see and feel beauty in a much wider range of possibilities.
Yeah. And that's good advice at any age, I guess, right?
Well, yeah, I wish I'd smartened up a lot earlier, you know. Why was I such an idiot before? But, you know, that's an unanswerable question.
What of the people around you, your wife especially, but the other people that are mentioned in the book, what have they thought of what you've written?
I think, I haven't heard from everybody, but I think they're okay. I tried not to be any less honest about anybody than I was about myself, and I was probably harder on myself than I was on them. You know, Johanna read the book twice, and I think in the first version there were two occasions where she said, you know, you've been a bit hard on both of us here because you're not being comprehensive enough. You're just being negative, you know. You're succumbing to the pressure to be dark, which is a strong pressure when you get older. And I think she was right about that, and I tried to be more comprehensive. But to my surprise, you know, it's not a confessional book. It's a candid book. Mm-hmm. And there's a big difference between confession and candor. Confession entails an apology. You know, you're going in saying, I'm confessing I've done something wrong. I've tried, I guess, as I get older, but I think partly it was having children and having my disabled son, but I've tried to get less judgmental. And I think as you get older, you get less judgmental. You have to be less judgmental. And so candor does not embarrass me. I hope it doesn't embarrass anybody else, but in a way, that's a problem I can't really solve for them.
It's a terrific book, though, Ian, and congratulations on it. Good luck with it.
Well, thanks. You know, that means a lot coming from you. It's always a pleasure to talk to somebody who cares so much about, you know, about writing. I mean, that's the great thing about as you get older, as I get older, I really begin to realize how important reading and writing are. You know, I thought I understood that before, but anyway, it's a pleasure to talk to somebody who understands that so much.
The book is called 60, A Diary of My 61st Year. It's published by Random House. The Globe and Mail's Ian Brown. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.